Welcome to the Oldie Podcast. This is from our literary lunch featuring guest speakers and kindly sponsored by Noble Caledonia, specialists in worldwide small ship cruising. Our lunches are held monthly. Details and how to book can be found in our magazine and on the website www.theoldie.co.uk.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you so much for coming to the Oldie Lunch today. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the universe, The Oldie. And we are only here thanks to the extreme kindness of our sponsors, Noble Caledonia, who do wonderful cruises on crucially very small ships. I've been on one, it's fantastic. And I am standing in the footsteps of the late, great Barry Cryer, who still accounts for a third of the Oldies website traffic. And he had a brilliant favourite. He was so amazing, he had categories of jokes, and he had a favourite gorilla joke. And his favourite gorilla joke was a gorilla walks into a pub and asks for a pint of bitter. "That'll be £6.50, said the barman. And the gorilla said, "What, that's outrageous." And the barman said, "Well, you're the first gorilla we've had in this pub." And the gorilla said, "I'm not surprised at those prices." We have three terrific speakers here today. The first is Jane Tippett, a historian who studied at Delaware University and Oxford, and she's got a book out tomorrow, actually, which will feature in the Oldie, about a lost photographer called Monsieur Patrick O'Higgins, the lost photographer. But she's here to talk about an extraordinary book she wrote last year, Once a King, the lost memoir of Edward VIII, which depended on finding gripping lost recordings of the Duke of Windsor. Ladies and gentlemen, Jane Tippett.
Thank you, Harry, for the very thoughtful introduction, and of course to the Oldie for having me. This is my ninth talk in just a little over a month, a true Once a King sprint, which has taken me to Charleston, South Carolina, New York, Los Angeles, Memphis, Tennessee, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and now to London, and of course here to the Oldie Literary Lunch. I'll confess to feeling slightly intimidated by the company I find myself mixing with today and Nick. Clearly very much a newbie and very much not an oldie. But nevertheless, you somehow allowed me to sneak in, giving me the chance to do what I absolutely love, which is to talk about this book and why I feel it is such an important moment in the biographical afterlife of its subject, Edward VIII, later the Duke of Windsor. There is no denying that the material I've presented in Once a King paints a very different portrait of Edward VIII than the one that we have in recent years become all too familiar with. Thanks to Peter Morgan and Alex Jennings, Edward, as a wastrel prince guided by selfish ambitions and Nazi sympathies, now dominates popular culture's understanding of his story. This, of course, is not the crown's fault alone, but rather the culmination of a thriving body of erstwhile historical studies by, as Edward's official biographer Philip Ziegler described them, his more venturesome critics, who, freed from the threat of libel, have in the years since the Duchess's death in 1986, created a suffocatingly repetitive narrative which has prevented a balanced understanding of Edward, his situation, and his impact on the evolution of 20th century British monarchy. I am no idealist, and I recognize that one book, however startling the primary material encompassed within it, will not overturn decades' worth of deeply instilled adverse judgments about this most controversial of British royals. Indeed, one of the challenges throughout the writing process, and now the speaking process, is how to present my subject in such a way that ensures an empathetic rather than sympathetic approach and privileges historical justice and human understanding over the one-dimensional discourse that currently prevails. Faced with an almost universally negative view of the Duke of Windsor, I am constantly aware of straddling this very delicate balance. I am no apologist, but I am a biographer who views him as a figure worthy of serious historical study. And what I mean by serious in this context is this: to neither condemn nor approve of him as a person, but bring fresh perspective on his very real contributions, and I would argue, centrality to the making of what today we call the modern monarchy. Amongst the many surprising finds in the archive of Charles J.B. Murphy, the long-suffering but long-inspired Time Inc. journalist who became Edward's ghostwriter, but more than that, his lifelong friend, was that both men shared these very concerns and were throughout the work on Edward's memoirs profoundly aware of the perils in presenting the Duke's story. "Many in England think I should not write this book," Edward told Murphy in late autumn of 1950. "They believe," he continued, "I should remain dead but unburied. Yet," he added, "I do not wish to be remembered only as a man who abdicated." Mm-hmm. Murphy was even more forthright about the challenges that lay ahead for a book that tried to argue for a more honorable vision of Edward's life and royal role. He believed, as he wrote in August 1948, "People in Britain of the upper middle classes, the county people, have no love for our author. That goes without saying. They want to hear no more from him. He shook their world. They want the skeleton to remain in the closet." My view, based on my experience thus far with Once a King, leads me to conclude that an element of Murphy's assessment still holds true today, and perhaps account for what has been barely a ripple of interest in Britain for this book, despite it marshaling together into a single narrative the most significant discovery of primary material related to Edward since his death in 1972, and enabling us for the first time to hear directly from him on subjects which have in subsequent years defined his legacy. Having decided to write a private memoir, his gift to eventual historians, as his erstwhile advisor Walter Monckton described it, between 1947 and 1950, Edward drafted content he had no intention of publishing, affording him an exercise that allowed him to explore his life with a freedom that would otherwise have been impossible. His writings, overlooked until now, even by Ziegler, tells the story of the two decades he spent as a serving Prince of Wales and his brief tenure as king, during which time he pioneered a new global brand of British royal identity, but along the way became alienated from both the country and class to which he belonged. He is at times painfully aware of his flaws and open about the many insecurities that produced compulsion to extreme physical exercise and borderline anorexia. In essays that address the complex family dynamics he grew up under and his approach toward marriage, we glimpse a man who thought reflectively about his past and acknowledged the at times uneasy pairing between himself and the institution, indeed family, he was meant to represent. Yet despite this, we gain a newfound appreciation through his writing of the vision he had for a redefined role as Prince of Wales and later as king, one that responded to the expectations of a 20th century public. His experiences as a serving officer in France during the First World War convinced him that in a post-war moment, it was his duty, as he wrote, to democratize the role of the royal family and to bring the monarchy closer to the people. He championed this outlook both in Britain and in its empire, where his success not only transformed him into an international celebrity, but infused the British monarchy with a dash of Hollywood-esque glamour, a quality it had never had before. With Murphy's assistance, Edward also addressed openly his feelings for Wallace Simpson, and through the diplomatic deft hand his ghostwriter helped on paper, Edward was able to confront the tumultuous struggle he faced in 1936 to balance what he believed was a moral obligation to Wallace with the demands of his constitutional role. The drama of the abdication is relived firsthand through Edward's voice, and we hear from him a frank, if not always factually foolproof, account of the defining event of his life and legacy. We are even afforded the opportunity, via Murphy's insistence, of hearing about the Windsors' impromptu meeting with Adolf Hitler in October 1937, a subject he addressed with Edward and with Wallace when he returned to the Windsors' orbit in the fall of 1954 to write The Duchess's Story, eventually published in 1956 as A Heart Has Its Reasons. In contrast to prevailing assumptions, Edward's private memoir reveals he remained proud of the position he had occupied, even as he wrestled with doubts as to whether his service had in fact meant something to the country of his birth. and acknowledged openly the reality that he and kingship had probably been ill-matched. "I believe in all truth," he told Murphy in the autumn of 1950, "that I brought the monarchy closer to the people, but in the process of doing so, I gradually lost faith myself in the institution." It is a profound remark and one that points to the roots of Edward's failure, but also makes the case for him as a truly modern monarch, one whose modernity enabled him to face the existential question of whether monarchy in a contemporary and democratic context is, after all, an oxymoron. Disregarding the inevitable questions of self-censorship and self-mythologizing that surround any autobiography, even an expurgated one, once a king and the material that it has brought into public light for the first time is remarkable and will, I believe, ultimately force a collective shift in how both the Duke and Duchess of Windsor are viewed. But that process, I now understand, will be a slow one. The negative interpretation of Edward closes down sound historical study still thrives, labeling anyone who questions it as an apologist. Yet I am confident that in time, Edward's words, which give us a remarkably different perspective on him, both as a person and as a prince, will help forge a new understanding of this very complicated man and his very complex story. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane, and I'm sorry for the interruption from an electronic member of the audience.
You have been listening to The Oldie Podcast. Please share this episode. Look out for The Oldie Magazine subscription offer on our website, www.theoldie.co.uk. Thank you and good luck.